Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome into another Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings. Our second podcast this week. Things are heating up. Baseball starts Thursday, so we did a lengthy season preview with Buster Olney and Preston Johnson that downloaded on Monday, July 20th. So go check that out. Coming up on this podcast, though, we're doing golf and UFC. We'll start with the man who is en fuego, to borrow a phrase from the great Dan Patrick. That is Wes Reynolds, who nailed another winner, had John Rahm. And that is two winners in four visits to the podcast. Pretty, pretty, pretty good. So well done by Wes. And then we'll wrap and we'll preview this weekend's tournament in Minnesota with him momentarily. And then Matthew Holt will wrap things up with me previewing the final card on Fight Island. So let's get to it.
Stop. Hammer time.
Conquering hero returns to the podcast. Wes Reynolds off his John Rahm bet and pick. Congratulations, my friend.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. And you know, when you got an 8-shot lead going into the back nine, you start to figure, okay, we can put our feet up and we're going to get an easy one. But with golf futures, they are never easy and they are never over until the scorecard is signed. And fortunately, the penalty was notified to Mr. Rahm before he did sign the scorecard. So, you know, so that didn't factor into play. But look, I think he was clearly the best on the weekend, but he started to leak a little bit of oil on the back nine. And everybody was like, okay, here comes the collapse. And I was like, just wait a minute, you know, let's take it easy here. But he certainly did make it interesting.
He certainly did. And well done. So your second win, I believe, in four appearances here on the podcast. So it's a pretty good performance. And you kind of sensed it, right? He had a really good final round last week, shot, I believe, a 64. And so you kind of sniffed that one out. So good on you. As we turn the page, and now we all want to make more money here. Let's talk about this course. What sort of overall impressions do you have here with the 3M tournament?
Yeah, it's an Arnold Palmer design. He and Tom Lehman, who's from up there in the Twin Cities area, Lehman consulted with him, but it's a Palmer design. So most of the Arnold Palmer designs that are played on the PGA Tour are pretty gettable. They're not very difficult courses for these top players. It got a renovation back in 2018 from Lehman and Tim Herron, and also Steve Wenzloff, who's the PGA Tour Vice President of Design Services. So par 71, 7,400 yards. You've got three shorter and drivable par fours that some of the longer hitters may be able to reach. I would expect low scoring. Last year was the first year that the PGA Tour had this event. This was played on the Champions Tour at this course from 2001 to 2018, that being the TPC Twin Cities. But Friday and Saturday, it's supposed to be a little bit windy. So 21 under was the winning score last year. So maybe this year it could be 18 or 19 under, but it's a relatively easy course. There was 60 is the course record that Paul Goito shot in a Champions Tour event in 2017. There were four rounds of 62 here last year. It really looks a little bit like a Florida type of course. If you look at the design, a lot of water in play on 10 holes throughout the golf course, bent grass greens. It is about 900 feet altitude, so the ball is going to fly a little bit further than normal. But what I looked at this week in terms of stats, I looked at mainly strokes gained off the tee, strokes gained approach. That's almost what I look at every week because the second shots are so important. But yeah, that's what you're looking for. If you look at the winner and the guys that finished near the top last year, Matthew Wolf only ranked 39th in the field in strokes gained putting. And I think Colin Morikawa, who ended up tied for second with Bryson DeChambeau, rated in the 40s. So it's not a course where you necessarily have to just putt the lights out. You just got to give yourself enough opportunities. Morikawa and Wolf last year at this event were 1 and 2 respectively in the field that week for strokes gained approach. So just hit good shots, keep it in the fairway, and reach the greens, and you're going to get a lot of looks for birdies this week.
All right, so on the top, not the same big names we've seen at the early part of this resumption after the pandemic sort of break. Dustin Johnson is your favorite, the only player at Caesars in single digits, 9-1 at the time of this tape being. And then some of the other games, Koepka's there at 17-1, Finau 18-1, Paul Casey 22-1, the aforementioned Matthew Wolff at 25-1. Eric Van Rooyen's getting a lot of buzz. He's 28-1. You can get better prices elsewhere. I would probably need bigger number than 28-1 to play him. Guy we've talked about on the podcast before with you, Wes, and that's Doc Redmond, getting a lot of buzz again this week at 40-1.
Yeah, and of the small price guys, and I'm talking 20 or lower, probably the one I could make a case for the best, even though I didn't play him, is Paul Casey, because when you look at the strokes gained off the tee, in terms of in this week's field, not overall on the tour ranking, but in this week's field, Paul Casey is number two in strokes gained off the tee and number one in strokes gained approach. He actually rates in the top 10 overall on tour in both categories. So that's the only one I really could have made a case for. And look, I don't think DJ is as bad as the double Jerry Rices that he shot last week, two rounds of 80, but it's hard for me to back at single digits or even 10 or 11-1. Brooks Koepka, who knows? I mean, is it one of those like Al Chervik things in Caddyshack, the Rodney Dangerfield, where the ball hits the arm and he's, oh, my arm, you know, when he's playing bad.
Yeah, I think it's broken.
Is that what it was with his knee? Because his knee was feeling fine after the RBC in South Carolina, and then I started to buy in. Now he's saying it didn't get any better. Fleetwood, look, came stateside last week. This is his first event post-pandemic. Played a practice round at Shinnecock last Monday and shot 64, and Shinnecock is where he finished second in the U.S. Open to Koepka a few years ago. But I need to see a little bit more, I think, to go right in there. But you did mention one guy that I did play, and I've got him at a much better price than 28-1. I wouldn't play him at 28 either, and that's EVR, Eric Van Rooyen, who has some local connections. He's a University of Minnesota graduate, played on the golf team, and just that name sounds Nordic, Doug. I mean, he sounds like he's a prospect that's about to be drafted in the NHL draft. Eric Van Rooyen from Lake Minnetonka or something, you know. That's what he sounds like. But he fits the profile here this week a little bit because he's still trying to accumulate the points to get his full-time PGA Tour card. He's just outside the top 40 in the world in the golf rankings. Finished T22 last week at Memorial, but he was second in the field in strokes gained approach and fifth in strokes gained tee to green. He lost, I think, a grand total of just a little bit north of three shots on the greens for strokes gained stats over four rounds. If he just stays at level and doesn't gain or lose anything on the greens, he ends up in the top 10. So Van Rooyen, it is a little bit trendy. I for sure wouldn't take the price from our friends at Caesars at 28, but you can find around 40. I think it's worth a stab.
Okay. So you've played him at a much better price. What are some of the other guys you've played?
Yeah, another local angle that I'll give, and he's probably in the high 60s to 70 range, is Troy Merritt.
And I've heard buzz on him.
Yeah, he finished T7 here last year and was tied for eighth at the Rocket Mortgage. And if he didn't lose some strokes on his approach game, he would have finished a lot higher. He wouldn't have had anything for Bryson DeChambeau in that tournament. But he's a guy that goes well on these courses, I think, where you got to shoot low scores, you know, kind of birdie fest. And he's also another local connection guy because although he was born in Iowa, he was pretty much raised in Minnesota. And actually grew up, actually where he went to high school, the town that Troy Merritt grew up in, I believe it's called Silver Lake Park is the town. Spring Lake Park, I'm sorry. Yeah, Spring Lake Park, Minnesota. He is a 6-minute drive from the golf course in Blaine, Minnesota. Also started his college career at Winona State and then transferred eventually and finished up at Boise State. But solid player that you're getting 70-something to one. Maybe you can find an 80 somewhere. But couple other guys in between that. Jonathan Vegas, around 80-1 most places. He's the top-ranked player in the field for strokes gained off the tee. The one guy in the field ahead of Paul Casey that's playing this week. Also top 10 in driving distance. He's a guy that can really bomb it. And what I mentioned earlier with these shorter par fours, he can attack them and have very short, almost like not even full wedges, just like pitch shots into the green, and should be able to make plenty of birdies. And then a guy that came noticed, if you were watching a few weeks ago at the Travelers Championship, Will Gordon. I took him in the 60-ish-to-1 range. He just turned professional. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Wolf and Morikawa last year when they had just turned professional. And they both battled for the win here last year at the 3M Open, and Wolf eventually got the win. But maybe Gordon fits that narrative this year. He shot 62 last month at the Travelers, tied for third, actually led the field that week. Despite how well Dustin Johnson played in the win, Will Gordon actually had the most birdies in the field with 27 over four rounds. And he's got unlimited sponsorship exemptions for the rest of the season, but he's still trying to get those points to get that full PGA Tour card. Obviously, if he wins an event, he gets the card automatically. That's a very similar situation to what Morikawa ended up having at the Barracuda Championship last year in Reno. So those were a few guys I played, and then I've got a couple longer bombs that I'll talk about shortly.
Yeah, so I'm not on anyone yet. I'm kind of easing into this. I was just getting back from a little R&R out of town, and a lot of these prices moved. Talked to a few people. Some of the sharper plays have kind of moved. So I'm not sure who I'm going to get involved with. I have some bombers. So let's talk about in terms of long shot odds. How do you feel about Aaron Weiss? 125-1, that range, former rookie of the year. Obviously his strength is his driver. So you just talked about it with Vegas. Why not participate in that with this guy?
Yeah, my long shots co-host that you can listen to our show on VSiN, Brady Cannon, actually likes Aaron Wise this week. That was one of his plays. And look, he's another one of those guys that goes really well when you get really lower scores. And he's a good product. He's actually right out here. You're probably familiar with him from your time in Vegas, a former UNLV player. Mm-hmm. So and actually, I believe actually was not a UNLV player. I correct that. I was confusing that with another guy, but he does live here in Las Vegas. He does have a residency. So a lot of Vegas connections from some of these players. And I couldn't argue with you on Wise.
Okay. What's another long shot you have?
Well, a couple I've got. One that I took at triple digits. You're now seeing him at 80 or 90-1 because there's a little bit of buzz on him, is Christopher Ventura. And if you're familiar with that name, if you follow college golf, you may realize that he was a teammate of Matthew Wolf, the winner here last year, and also Victor Hovland at Oklahoma State. They were all part of that 2018 Oklahoma State National Championship team squad. And Ventura is a guy that was actually born in Mexico but raised in Norway and now resides down in Palm Beach, Florida. Had an inauspicious start to start the season, missed four straight cuts, and then out of the pandemic, went back down to the Korn Ferry Tour. And he's played pretty solid since the restart in June. He's got a couple top tens at TPC courses, which they are playing this week. And the TPC courses are a little bit easier. And really what the PGA Tour wanted to do with those TPC courses is to make them kind of affordable courses for average players to play, because most golfers can't play the courses that the pros play on TV, but they can with the TPC courses. But anyway, Ventura, two top tens, one at Sawgrass and one at San Antonio last week, a respectable finish just outside the top 20 in Detroit. He's got a lot of potential and a lot of pedigree. He's the one that doesn't get as much hype as his fellow Oklahoma State Cowboys, Wolf and Hovland, but he's a good young player, and that's one of those guys. And I think with this event being so wide open, where the favorites are kind of tepid, and it's not a really deep field in terms of highly ranked players. There's only six of the top 30 in the world that are playing this week, with the St. Jude on deck and then the PGA following that. So this is kind of one of those sandwiched a little bit dead weeks. And this is a guy that I think can strike And then one, I'm going to go a real long shot. How about 300 to 1? I know you like those long shots.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I know you like those. And I got one here, Derek Ernst. And if that's a familiar name, keen golf observers will remember that he is a former winner on the PGA Tour. Now, you got to go all the way back to 2013 to remember that win. That was at the Wells Fargo Championship. And I remember it was very nasty and rainy conditions. He actually got into that field as a fourth alternate. And I think he was like ranked somewhere a little bit above 1,200 in the world in the official world golf rankings. Well, he won that tournament, got the exemption on the PGA Tour, and then after 2016, lost the tour card. And he's kind of been grinding on the Korn Ferry Tour essentially ever since, the former Web.com Tour. But he does come into the event with some good form. He's got finishes of 10, 12, and 5 over the last 3 weeks on the Korn Ferry. And I think he's 42nd, I checked this morning, in the earnings. You got to get in the top 25 on the Korn Ferry to get your guaranteed playing privileges on the PGA Tour. But he's not playing the Korn Ferry this week. He elected to go ahead and play here. So I'm trusting maybe that he knows something, or I'm going to trust his judgment that he thinks he can go well here. And he does come in with a little bit of confidence, at least.
What odds did you get him at?
I got him at 300 to 1.
He's 80 to 1 at
wow.
Fingers.
Most places I've seen him at least high 100s or 200s, and a couple shots I saw him at 300. So maybe those folks at Caesars, they kind of see what I see in lowering that price a little bit on open, is that he has been contending. He was actually the 54-hole leader last weekend in San Antonio before it ended up finishing fifth. So, you know, maybe they're looking at that and they've knocked down that price, but definitely shop around on Mr.
Yeah.
Ernst.
I don't think you recommend 80 to 1. So I like the Ventura. That he's 50 to 1, though, at Caesars. Again, that's, you know, Caesars. Offshore right now, I see 250 to 1 on Ernst. And for Ventura, just to give perspective, so I see 70 to 1. So
yeah, that's about the range, because he has been tipped by a couple notable guys that can maybe move markets overseas that have good reputations for that. So it doesn't surprise me to see him like 70 or 80 to 1, because he was at about, I think, 120 or somewhere around that before he got tipped. So on balance, you're looking at probably near an 80 to 1 with Ventura.
Okay. All right. So that's good. And then, so I have a bomber. I keep saying bomber. He is, you know, it obviously fits when there's big drivers, but I'm talking about just long shot. You mentioned the guy, you just had your guy, your long shot, who had a previous PGA Tour win. Well, this guy has also been performed well on the tour. It's just been a long time ago. Jason Duffner at 175 to 1.
I could sponsor that. I was actually on him, I believe. I'm trying to remember where I used him. I may have used him at the RBC Heritage. But Duffner, you know, he's been turning it around a little bit in terms of he's been making some cuts. And, look, we know that his former pedigree, I mean, he's not near the level he was when he was a PGA champion. And then he won a couple events. I believe it was three seasons ago. But, you know, he's not near that stead. That's why, of course, he's priced at 175 to 1. But he's been making some cuts. Played here last year, did make the cut on the number, didn't really contend. Now 43. But look, these events, Doug, it's so hard to really argue against a lot of guys, because we only have 1 year of form. It's not like where it's like, okay, this guy is a real horse for the course here. Well, hell, we don't know that, because a lot of guys are either making their debut or have only played here one time. So, yeah, this is the week, I think. I know that we've had relatively, even if they haven't been the clear favorite, but relatively chalky winners with Rahm in the 20-ish range, Morikawa 30 to 1, Bryson, of course, at 6 to 1, DJ in the 20 to 25 range. Daniel Berger was probably the longest shot we had, and he was like 60 or 70 to 1. So you haven't seen a lot of these triple-digit guys I think since really Nick Taylor at Pebble Beach, where he won wire to wire, and he was, I think, about 125 or 150. But this could be the week where it's going to happen, because I think it's so close to a major. And look, you get into the time this time of year where guys are playing for different priorities. Guys are playing maybe to try to get in majors. Guys are also trying to play to get into that FedEx Cup 125 that'll be in the playoffs next month. Guys are trying to keep their cards. Guys are trying to, you know, reach some kind of world ranking milestone, get in the top 50 or get into the top 100. So you get all these different motivations, and that's what I think opens it up for a potential big price to win here.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, only six of the top 30 golfers are in this field, so it's just wide open, as you were alluding to and explaining. So those are the guys I'm kind of circling. There's some others that have come across my desk, if you will, in terms of people I respect touching on it. Cameron Davis was another one, 250 to 1. He's missed the cuts, but three of the four missed cuts were all around the number. So he's right there, has good putting splits for this grass. You know, his number is usually 150 to 1-ish, so 250 to 1, mm-hmm. but I can't support that, do you?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to take some of these guys, and like I did kind of with Ernst this week, a lot of these guys that are either 60 to 1 or even into the triple digits, do some top 20s maybe this week or some top 10s and split them up if you don't want to go all in on the outright, because they may not win, but they could be on that first or second page of the leaderboard. And look, like Derek Ernst this week, 11 to 1. As top 20, that pays the same if you're going to take DJ to win the darn thing. So,
right.
You know, yeah, don't ignore those top 10s or top 20 markets or if you have certain outs that maybe have different placing markets, but definitely go to work on those this week.
Yeah. And that you see markets move like Ernst at Caesars. Sometimes you'll catch a stale number in some of the derivatives and some of the, top 10s, top 20. So sometimes you can catch it.
Right. That's the same principle too. Like when we get into a football betting or basketball betting, where the full game number will move, but the first quarter or the first half number won't move as much. And you can still get more of an advantage in derivative markets, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I'm out of guys. You got anyone else? Parting shot here?
Just one more. I played Keith Mitchell as well. I played him at 125. He's still, I think, around 100 most places I've seen. Tied for 22nd last week at the Memorial. Hit a bomb on him a couple years ago at 200 to 1 for the Honda Classic. Hasn't won since, but he was third last week in greens and regulation at Muirfield Village, where there were some really tough pins, especially on the weekend and especially on Sunday. Those were not really gettable pins, and they were going to be tough greens to hit, and being third in the field was no small feat for that. He also has a solid record and some wind. If I'm thinking that the wind, if I'm looking at the forecast correctly and seeing that the wind should blow a little bit more on Friday and Saturday, this is a guy that has fared well in some windy conditions going all the way back to 2018 in the Dominican Republic, where the wind was howling and he finished second. And he's also kind of got a little bit of an Arnold Palmer course correlation. Whenever anybody thinks of an Arnold Palmer designed golf course, what do they think of? They think of Bay Hill in Orlando. That's kind of his signature course and essentially what was the King's home. But you look at Mitchell the last couple years, sixth and fifth in 2019 and 2020 at the Bay Hill Invitational at Arnie's Place. So if there's some kind of course correlation design with Bay Hill and with TPC Twin Cities, Mitchell would certainly fit that bill.
There you go. All right, my man. That's all I got. That should be good. And hopefully we'll have another winner in the needle in the haystack.
Yeah, hopefully, because it will be more of a needle in a haystack. We've had some quality at the top to really choose from last week. Not as much here, but that's what makes it fun, and it could be a life changer for somebody this week, either a better at a big price or one of these professionals that get a career milestone. So hopefully that happens.
All right, my man. Thanks. Oh, we appreciate your time very much, and best of luck once again.
You got it, Doug, man. Thanks for always having me. Appreciate it.
So thanks to Wes Reynolds. Hopefully he can stay hot. And remember, you always want to kind of find some top 20s, some top 10s to maybe pay for your futures tickets. Don't forget, baseball finally makes its return to television. Make sure you're keeping up with all the major league news with Buster Olney and the Baseball Tonight podcast. Download and subscribe to Baseball Tonight as well as Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And just a friendly reminder, that baseball podcast here on the Behind the Bets sort of thread was posted on Monday. Go check it out. And now we wrap things up with UFC. It's just been a monster this summer, really bailing out the sports world on so many levels. And this Saturday will be the fourth and final fight card for Fight Island. Matthew Holt back with us. How are you, sir?
Doing great, Doug. Doing great. Look, it's been quite the summer for UFC action as we went from the Apex here in Nevada and Las Vegas with the 25-foot smaller octagon. Now we're over in Abu Dhabi on Fight Island, and still no fans, but I think it's interesting, and I think, you know, we saw a lot of those trends in the smaller octagon. So many of the undercard fights leading to early stoppages with the smaller octagon. And I think we've learned some things about Abu Dhabi as well, and I'm excited to get into this card.
Well, yeah, I'm interested to hear your take. I think you sniffed it out very early in terms of Bisping influencing judges, and then we saw it, I believe, last week with the refereeing, when he talked about how two fighters were caught sort of in a standstill in the corner, not doing anything. He says something, and then the ref immediately stands him up. So I think that was either last week or maybe last Wednesday. But yeah, I mean, we've seen sort of the no fans, what that means. It means you can hear the corners more easily. You can hear the broadcasters. And obviously, when you are a former champ like Bisping, you have sort of influence on all parties. And it's fascinating. It's part of the handicap. So let's get right to it. We'll start with the main event, kind of a coin flip line, which is refreshing because sometimes we've gotten these big numbers. Robert Whittaker minus $1.20 at Caesars, over under 4.5 in this middleweight clash. It's interesting because Whittaker, he had won 9 straight, hadn't lost since 2014, but then loses to Adesanya. So this is his first bout since then, and he's obviously even much better at the middleweight level. But the question is, after being taken down, is he still have the same chin? And I think that's the interesting thing as he faces Till here.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I wonder if his heart's in it right now, because this is a guy who's dealt with a lot of injuries, you know, especially had some knee problems and knee injuries. And I have to say, I think he felt a little burned out going into that Adesanya fight. And then after losing to Adesanya, he talked about taking some significant time off this year and potentially not fighting again until the winter. He had a couple of fights he was looking at that kind of got scrapped, and now all of a sudden he finds himself in this Till fight, and I hope his heart's in it. I hope he's 100, you know, I'm just a pro fighter. Whittaker is amazing. I'm not trying to insinuate he's not training hard or anything, but it's going to be interesting to see where his mindset is in this one coming off that KO loss.
Right, so Till coming off the loss to Tyron Woodley, the way he lost the welterweight title shot, he's never gone to fourth and fifth round. So that is interesting to me. I actually am leaning to the under and Whittaker here because, you know, Whittaker just being a little bit more talented, but you wonder about his heart being in it, right, his mindset being right. And I kind of lean to the under here.
Actually like the over. So here, you know, again, with main events, especially with, to your point, a guy like Darren Till, this is, you know, this is a big fight for him. We expect that he may come out a little bit cautious, and they both have similar styles. They're both stand-up kickboxers at the end of the day, basically, especially Darren Till. And they both fought a lot of kickboxers. Look at Whitaker's resume, Uriah Hall, you know, Yoel Romero. All those fights were standing. Rafael Natal, Brad Tavares, another stand-up striker. 6 of his 11 wins in the UFC, Robert Whittaker, have come by decision. And what's really interesting is while Darren Till is known as a big stand-up striker, kickboxer, a guy who carried some pretty big power at welterweight, 10 knockouts and 18 career wins, 4 of his last 5 wins, so four of the 6 wins that Darren Till has in the UFC are by decision. So as he has stepped up his level of competition, we've seen that power level dissipate, not to mention he's moving up to middleweight where he has one fight where he successfully defeated Kelvin Gastelum in his middleweight debut. So I'm not sure that Darren Till is going to carry the same power up to middleweight that he did at welterweight. And even at welterweight, as the competition got better, what we've seen is basically 67% of his wins inside the UFC have come by decision anyway, 4 of 6, and 4 of his last 5 wins come by decision. I think more often than not, this is going to be a stand-up kickboxing match with a guy, Robert Whittaker, whose defense is pretty good, Darren Till. We'll have to see how his chin holds up. We'll have to see, are there any residual effects from Whittaker's chin after being knocked out in his last fight? But what we do tend to see sometimes from strikers, and Robert Whittaker certainly is one, is that first fight after you get knocked out, sometimes you're a tiny bit gun-shy. And if either guy is just a little bit gun-shy here, this one could turn into a slower, technical kickboxing match. And at that point, I like the over 4.5 rounds at plus 125 in a situation where prior to this past Saturday's submission win by Figueiredo in the for the flyweight championship, we basically have seen nothing but overs in main events since COVID started. I don't really want to buck that trend here. The stats say that this thing should be a slight favorite toward the over. Instead, it's a pretty good favorite toward the under. I'm going to take the plus money and think that this one might see the judges' scorecards.
Okay, a couple things. I was leaning that under because I don't think it's going to be a first or second round. So I'm thinking like third, maybe fourth. So that's why it's going to be so close in my eyes. But you raise good points. I'm curious as to why you think like the fact that it's a main event going over 4.5, sort of that trend, why that matters, why that is not just a randomness.
Well, what we tend to see from guys that haven't fought a lot in 5-round fights is they tend to come out slow because they're not 100% sure about their gas tank. Will I have gas in the tank in rounds 4 or 5? So I wouldn't be surprised if Till starts a little slow anyway. And when you get 2 really good technical kickboxers in a match, and that's what these guys are, a lot of times you have to figure each other out, kind of get the style, get the pace. Where things get crazy a lot of time is if you have a power puncher versus a technical striker or a grappler versus striker, where they're both trying to implement different styles, and that's where they clash and maybe lead to an early finish. But in this case, you have 2 technical kickboxers. We see it with wrestlers all the time. We get 2 amazing wrestlers in there and nobody can get a takedown because their wrestling negates each other. In this case, 2 technical kickboxers in there. I think that they're both going to understand what the other's trying to do, be a little cautious, and I think that there's a good chance it goes the distance. And look, more often than not, Darren Till's fights in the UFC go the distance, and 6 out of 11 wins for Whittaker on the other side go the distance as well. It seems like from a statistical standpoint, the over 4.5 rounds should be the favorite, but instead it's plus 125. So that's where I landed.
Okay, so you see value there. Co-main event, and this is just remarkable. The final fight for Antonio Nogueira, the third in meeting between with Shogun Hua. They first met in 2005, the Pride Critical Countdown. So 15 years later, Nogueira is going to wrap it up and call it a career. So he said he's going to retire after this bout. So it's fitting that these two are squaring off. You got Hua minus -190. I'm actually willing to lay it. I think Nogueira's done. Hua's obviously older as well, but he's looked okay in recent fights. I think he's just gotten more there, and Nogueira's on his way out.
I'll tell you what, I almost landed on that exact same side, and it's very possible because obviously on fight night and after weigh-ins, we're taping here early in the week, after you see guys, how they look, weigh-ins, and then on fight night, I tend to add to my card significantly every single time. And Shogun Hua very well may end up on my card as well, because I agree with you. I mean, we haven't seen fighters fare very well in their announced farewell fights historically. That tends to not go well. So at 44 years old, you have to wonder what Nogueira has left in the tank anyway. But I like the over 1.5 rounds here, because the one thing we've seen from Shogun Hua is that he's not a quick one-punch banger guy anymore. 6 of his last 8 fights have gone to at least round 3, and the total in here is 1.5. the last time that Shogun Hua got a win that came inside the first 7.5 minutes, so basically 1.5 rounds of a fight, was 2013 versus James Tahuna. There's a name, a blast from the past. James Tahuna. So we're talking over 7 years since Shogun Hua has finished a fight inside of 7.5 minutes. And on the other side, 6 of the last 11 for Rogerio Nogueira have also gone to at least round 3. 7 of the last 11 have at least gone 7.5 minutes into round 2. And prior to that span, first round knockout in his last fight, he hadn't been knocked out in the first round, Rogerio Nogueira, since 2014 against Rumble Johnson. And that was a Rumble Johnson in his prime when he could really bang. That was a scary, scary puncher, Rumble Johnson, back then. So literally all the stats say, you know, this is probably going to be a slower plodding affair. Shogun Hua is probably going to be a little more quicker. He's probably going to have a little more tools in the box. He won the first two fights, both by decision, both went the distance, obviously. But I think this one probably at least gets through the first 7.5 minutes, and maybe we get a late round 2 KO or a round 3 KO. But the stats tell us this one's supposed to make it a while. So I took the over 1.5 rounds, and I only had to lay 120.
Yeah, I understand the total being 1.5, just given that we're not sure how much these guys have left in the tank. But to your point, the first two meetings went the distance, both unanimous decisions for Hua. I think you got me on that. I think I'm just worried about, you know, Nogueira just being overwhelmed and just completely, you know, just past his prime. And that's my, I guess, my apprehension. But that's probably why it's 1.5, right? I mean, that's factored in to the odds. Let's go to the next fight on the card. Alexander Gustafsson, a big favorite, minus 350 over Fabricio Werdum. Total here is 2.5 in this heavyweight clash. Gustafsson coming up. It's his first fight since retiring last year, but he's coming up to heavyweight. And look, he has the takedown defense, 85% here. He should be fine. And Werdum has weak takedown percentages. So you would think this is going to be on the ground. I lean to the under 2.5 here and even go Gustafsson inside the distance for the win.
Yeah, this one was so tough for me to figure out here at the end of the day, and I think it's gotten personal here as Gustafsson's gone on a little bit of a rampage talking about how he broke the nose of Werdum in a sparring session. Werdum obviously saying that's not exactly what happened, but now Werdum is 42 years old, not sure what he has left in the tank. In his last fight, he might have got off to one of the worst starts I've ever seen in heavyweight history for a fight that actually somehow went the distance versus Alexei Oleinik, where he just got bombarded with punches and did not have an answer. He looked really soft and really flabby around the midsection. And Oleinik, who's a career grappler, really, was just unloading with shots. Probably didn't have the striking capabilities to put him away. And then Werdum rallied a little late as the gas tank of Oleinik ran out and almost got a submission win on his own in the third round. I get why this line is where it's at. I mean, 42-year-old Fabricio Werdum, and the way he looked, not just performance in the octagon in his last fight, but the way he looked physically, I think, is also factored into this line because he did not look good physically. But I also think there's a lot of question marks around Alexander Gustafsson as well. I know he's taken some time off now. He hasn't fought in 13 months, but he's lost 4 of his last 6 fights, and he got finished in his last 2 fights, and he got finished in 3 of his last 4 losses. So I'm a little bit concerned about, you know, the durability of Alexander Gustafsson here. I certainly think there is a scenario or at least a path to victory where an over-aggressive Alexander Gustafsson, negates his ability or, you know, neglects his takedown defense and gets taken down here and submitted by Fabricio Werdum. I think I'm looking to the under in this one because if the same Fabricio Werdum comes out that came in against Oleinik, he's not going to be able to withstand the beating that Gustafsson will be able to put on him early. And on the other side, if Gustafsson makes a mistake, Fabricio Werdum is still one of the best jiu-jitsu submission artists that there is ever in the history of heavyweight MMA. So you could see that path to a finish for both guys. And at the end of the day, the under 2.5 rounds on a heavyweight fight is only a minus 120. So I think I'm probably leaning toward the under. But I also agree with you, maybe Gustafson by finish. If you can lay less than minus 120 on Gustafson by finish, then maybe that's the better value here as well.
Yeah, I've seen minus 110 even. So it should be out there. And I was checking last night before we taped this morning. So that's my sort of assessment. But I do like the under 2.5 quite a bit as well. The next fight, the over-under is severely juiced. Carla Esparza and Marina Rodriguez, 2.5 over minus 450. We know a lot of women's fights go the distance. This is a strawweight battle. Esparza, the former Tough Season 20 champ. She lost her title, though. This is really – I mean, I lean Rodriguez here. She is minus -175, but I kind of want to take a piece of the under just because takedowns will be a big part of Esparza's attack.
So this brings me to my first really – the facts that I've learned about Abu Dhabi so far, and that is American fighters, period, are 7-14 in those fights. But if we remove the fights where an American fought an American, then we end up with a situation where American fighters are 3-10 over on Fight Island so far. 3-10, and that includes, and I included a couple of guys who aren't American but exclusively live and train in America now. But if we look at how big, it wasn't like they were all underdogs either. Kelvin Gastelum was a small favorite. Martin Day was a big favorite. Montel Jackson was minus 220. Al Hassan was minus 340. Max Holloway was, you know, he was a small dog. Paige Van Zandt was a big dog, so maybe we can cast that out. But we're talking Americans went 3-10, and in many of those fights were a favorite and a sizable favorite in many cases with Jackson and Al Hassan. So I'm wondering, what is it about? Is it the long trip? Is it the crazy time difference and they're not able to adjust? Why are American fighters performing so poorly over in Fight Island? Because I will say that right out of the gate, before I looked at that stat, I was thinking about taking a shot on Carla Esparza. I like Esparza. I think her striking game's gotten better. You know, when she won the tough tournament to become the first ever strawweight champion, she was more of a one-dimensional wrestler, ground and pound, but I thought her overall game has gotten a lot better and that maybe she would be a live dog here. But I'm very concerned about how poorly Americans as a whole, and it's not the biggest sample size, 13 fights, but that's a pretty good size sample size, 13 fights, and Americans have performed very poorly. So I'm staying away from this one just because of that poor performance. And inability to even come anywhere close to meeting expectations thus far for American fighters over on Fight Island.
So why not take the Brazilian Rodriguez?
Because I wanted to take Esparza here.
And okay.
So it just, you know, since I wanted Esparza and the stats are going against her, it's a pass for me.
Because Rodriguez, what, she's 12-0-2 MMA record. She's a 5-inch height advantage and a 2-inch reach advantage in this bout. And she has a 70% takedown defense percentage. So clearly she's going to be ready for Esparza's wrestling. I mean, granted, you're laying a -175, so it's not exactly a pick 'em fight. And that -175 translates to 64%. So she has to have a better than 64% chance in your eyes to see sort of value here. And that's Rodriguez. So do you see any chance at the under here? Because the under is really tempting at nearly 4-1.
I don't know. So, I mean, I think this one's very likely to go to a decision, actually. I certainly don't want to lay the over, but I think there is a possibility that if this line continues to drop, and I have seen it drop a little bit, and I wouldn't be surprised if it continues to drop because Esparza is a big name, she's a former champion, and not as many people are familiar with Rodriguez, but Rodriguez has been in there with some real tough girls, including Cynthia Calvillo, Tisha Torres, who looked amazing in her last fight, Tisha Torres. Rodriguez beat her. The more I look at this fight and the more I look at the fact that Americans have struggled so greatly in Abu Dhabi, there's a shot that if this thing goes below 160, I may end up on Rodriguez.
Okay. Good stuff. So let's track the money line movement as we approach Saturday's card. Keep going down
the fight card or the lineup here for the main card. Paul Craig minus $1.20 against Antugalov. 1.5 here is the over-under for this light heavyweight battle. Now, there's a distinct advantage for Craig here. 6-inch reach advantage. 6 inches, 4 inches in height. Now, we saw one last week, and I'm blanking on the names, but the height and the reach were not went to a decision. And I forget, it was Reed, was it, who won the decision, even though not having such a reach disadvantage. So Craig's minus $1.20 here. I got no play.
I don't either. And the one thing, and I know that most people I've talked to that I really respect about their opinions in MMA don't expect this one to last long. They think this thing's going to end quickly, that one of these guys is going to get choked out. That's why we have a situation, and this is rare. When you look at these two guys, you're talking about 4 knockouts and 20 wins for Antigolov, and for Craig, what is that, I think 1 knockout? Yeah, 1 knockout and 12 wins. Yet we have an under, over-under of 1.
Right.
And a half.
They're both grapplers. That's the thing.
That's right. So they're basically saying, hey, these guys are going to get right after it and somebody's going to get submitted quick. But what makes me nervous here is they're both the exact same replicas of each other in terms of what they're going to try to do in there. And I wonder if their abilities on the ground aren't going to negate each other a little bit. And if they do, I don't know that I want to be on the under. But I haven't found a person that thinks this thing's getting out around 1. So it's a no play for me. But I am a little bit intrigued by the over because I always feel like you get 2 ace grapplers in there and they're both defensively understand what the other one's trying to do. Is there a shot this thing gets into round 2?
It's funny, I was leaning over, but I'm just, you basically articulated every reason why. I think it's just right on the, you know, you could have a submission so quickly, but the guys are really skilled, and therefore you could also have them just sort of one guy get leverage against the fence, and then all of a sudden he can't get submitted, but he gets out of it. And I mean, look, there's been some coin, like there's so many sort of, oh, he almost had him, or, you know, there are points that are these fights that go the distance where they weren't just straight overs from the start, right? You had a couple near submissions and near tap outs. So with this 1.5, I it's a pass for me.
Yeah, me too. And to your point, a lot of times the difference between getting finished and finishing someone is just knowing how to keep my arm in to give me in half an inch of space to breathe, or these little tiny things that these grappling aces understand. And both of these guys are grappling wizards. I could certainly see this one getting to round 2 or 3, or, you know, them negating each other on the ground. So I'm with you there. If I was going to take a flyer on anything, it'd probably be the plus money on the over.
Okay, next fight on the card, Alex Oliveira minus $1.70 against Peter Sabata. This is the conventional 2.5 total in this welterweight match. This is interesting because Sabata, this is his second stint, I should say, with the UFC. The metrics favor his grappling. But Oliveira here fought in March, won via split decision, snapped a 3-fight skid. His metrics favor striking. I'm not going to lay the $1.70 here.
No, in fact, I already played Peter Sabata in this matchup, and I feel pretty confident that it's kind of strength versus weakness on both sides here. You know, Sabata's kryptonite has always been elite-level strikers, and make no mistake about it, Cowboy Oliveira is an elite-level striker, maybe not the same level as some of the guys that have beaten Sabata. But there's a couple of things here. Number one, half of all Alex Oliveira's 8 losses come by submission. He's been very susceptible to submissions, even in fights that he's winning. Go back and watch the fight that he had versus Gunnar Nelson, where he was hammering Gunnar Nelson and then got caught in a rear naked choke, and boom, was it. It was done. He's not very good at defending submissions. And on the other side, Peter Sabata coming off a knockout loss to Leon Edwards, which is, look, there's no shame in that. You know, Leon Edwards is one of the 3 best welterweights in the entire world. I think that this one's kind of strength versus weakness both ways, but I like Sabata a little better. I think he's been the more durable guy. Other than the loss to Edwards, you know, you take that out and he's 4-1 in the UFC, including a unanimous decision win over Nicholas Dalby. And I think that's important because we have an example here and a common opponent that they both fought fairly recently. So they both, you know, Oliveira fought Dalby two fights ago. Zabata fought Nicholas Dalby three fights ago. Zabata was able to handle Nicholas Dalby, but Nicholas Dalby was able to handle Cowboy Oliveira. And his split decision win in Max Griffin, which was a true 50-50 coin flip, had he have lost that fight and ended up on the wrong side of a coin flip decision, it's very possible we don't have this fight because Cowboy Oliveira isn't in the UFC after four straight losses. This is a guy who historically finds ways to lose fights a lot of times, even in situations where he's winning. I think he doesn't understand risk management, something you and I have talked about many times, where fighters are way ahead in fights and then unnecessarily put themselves in positions to turn that win into a loss. That's been the story of Cowboy Oliveira. And on top of it, look, if Zabata gets him on the ground, there's a very good chance he submits him because Oliveira has been susceptible to that throughout his entire career. And we look at some common opponents recently, certainly favors Zabata as well. And we're getting plus 160 on this fight. Some of that has to do with the fact that Oliveira has a big name. You know, it's Cowboy Oliveira, and he comes in, and his fights are exciting, and he's a memorable guy. But at the end of the day, if you just break this one down from a pure strength versus weakness standpoint, recent common opponents, recent trends, then I think when you consider the price, it's very easy to land on Peter Zabata, and I did in this case.
Yeah, and you're getting plus money. I think that's strong to make a case for that. I have zero feel for this one, but you laid out a really strong rationale and presented it well, so maybe our listeners are convinced. The next fight on the card is, I know why, but it's just straight. It's my favorite fight. I'm, like, most interested to see this just because Shemaev just fought a week ago, so it's ridiculous. He's going against McKee here. He's minus 1,100. I really like the under 1.5. The guy is just a monster. He's only been stopped once in his MMA career. Excuse me, McKee has. So these, it's just a contrast in styles. But I have to take the guy who's just an animal and wants to end these fights early. He didn't get touched last week. He had a second round submission against John Phillips, and I'm expecting a win inside the distance is probably going to be my play.
Yes, I agree with all of that, except I don't. So what are we at for a total? 1.5?
1.5.
I'm trying to see the juice toward the under here. Under minus 240.
Okay, see, I did not. Okay, that's moved then since I last saw this.
Yeah, I knew it moved big last night, so that's why I wanted to look at it really quickly, because at 240 on the under,
that's too much.
Yes, because McKee is going to understand. Everyone knows what Shemaev wants to do. He's going to take you down and unleash some of the most vicious ground and pound you've ever seen. But a little bit of what happened in the last fight, I don't want to say it was an aberration because it wasn't. I mean, it was again, strength versus weakness. But we all knew that Phillips only shot, and I actually made a play on Phillips at a huge plus money on the underdog, was that he had to land a big strike. You had a massive power puncher going against this grappler, and Phillips got taken down in 10 seconds, literally got taken down in 10 seconds and never got up again in the first round. So once he got taken down right away and didn't get to land a strike, you knew it was going to look really ugly, and it did. So, but at the end of the day, McKee can't have worse takedown defense than Phillips, and he knows exactly what Shemaev wants to do. Even if he's not offensively trying to win the fight, even if his plan is, well, I know I have to stuff takedowns, I'm not sure that he doesn't make it for a couple rounds with ground and pound. And yeah, I don't know. I'm nervous about betting the under at minus 240. I have to stay away from this one because the favorite, who's a justifiable favorite, but look, he's also doing a very quick turnaround, kind of an unprecedented situation, and the under are such big favorites that it's, you know, I don't know that I want to risk either, and I'm probably going to stay away.
Yeah, I haven't seen any props yet in terms of what Shemaev would be inside the number. I mean, it's basically a parlay between the two. But, man, it's tempting just because you just know how it's going to play out. You kind of do.
I think, really, if inside the number is less than minus 300, then it's probably a great value. My guess is it's probably like minus 400. But if you could find Shemaev inside the distance at minus 300, you're right. That's going to be awful tempting to take.
Well, hold on a sec. I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're saying it's – no, if the over-under is minus 240 and then you're putting another, you know, outcome on there, so to speak, it's going to be less than that.
So if you did a parlay minus 1,100 and minus 250, let me see. Yeah, I think you're right. I think we might be in the minus 250 range.
Well, obviously, inside the distance, just to be fair, is less, you know, obviously more time than a 2.5. Just, you know, obviously splitting hairs a little bit, but we got to at least mention that. So I can actually look to see right now what it would be.
I was doing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's some others out there. But, yeah, I mean, you're looking at, you know, like around 200.
Calculate. Yeah.
Now, this total was minus 210, so that's why it's a little bit better payout. But, yeah, I mean, that's what we're looking at. So that's why I think that's the play. Shemaev inside the distance. And hopefully the prop, you know, the prop, you'll be able to get something like minus 200 out there.
Yeah, that's probably the right play then. I don't disagree with that.
But as I mentioned, McKee's only been stopped once in his career. And actually, hold on a sec. We should back up. The over-under is 1.5. So it's going to be a lot different than his win inside the distance. So 2.5, if the over-under was 2.5 inside the distance, those are comparable. This is obviously a lot wider. So that'll be different. So if you could find a parlay between the two, it'll pay pretty solid, like minus 200 or less. But if it was Chimaev inside the distance, you might be having to go minus $3 or so.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I think okay. Right. Yeah. My train of thought skipped that. So we apologize. We probably could have been a little bit more concise on that. So that's what we're looking. We're going to have to wait for the props to come out. You have a couple plays on the undercard. Why don't you get to those?
Sure. So I took Tom Aspinall, Jake Collier, under 1.5, plus 130. Look, normally any two heavyweights plus 130 on the under, I'm probably going to be tempted to lean toward that side anyway, regardless of who the two people are. But in this case, Aspinall's huge, 6'5", just a big, giant heavyweight, 5 of 7 wins by knockout, making his UFC debut, but spent most of his career at Cage Warriors, which is probably the most reputable organization over there in England in terms of MMA. 2 of the 4 losses for Collier come by KO, and he's moving up from light heavyweight to heavyweight here, and he's probably going to be giving up about 30 pounds. And again, this is another one of those situations where I was originally looking toward Aspinall because of that, how bad Americans have fared. We talked about it, 3-10 in fights where it's American versus a non-American in Fight Island. That's the case for Collier. So not only does he have to buck this, whatever is happening with American fighters, whether it's the time zone, the heat, whatever it might be, that's causing them to have such disappointing performances, but he's also moving up in weight. He's going to be significantly smaller. I mean, we saw that in the two cards ago where we had Marcin Tybura taking on essentially a light heavyweight, and it just the light heavyweights have a hard time getting it done here at heavyweight a lot of times. I think Collier is going to be at a big disadvantage in terms of the fact that they both want to do the same things. Where he might be able to get something done is very early in the fight with his speed and punching ability. Maybe he can land something big again, but that leans toward the under as well. So I played under 1.5 rounds plus 130 in the Aspinall-Collier fight. And the other one I have is a pretty big underdog in Mike Grundy versus Mosvar Evloev. And this is one of those situations where the young Russian fighter is 26 years old. He's 12-0. He's an unbelievable grappler, but he's kind of one-dimensional. He really is. Get the takedown, ground and pound. I mean, that is the whole strategy here for Evloev in this fight. But on the other side, Mike Grundy, who's 33 years old now, and just coming off a really impressive knockout win in his UFC debut against Nadir Amani. It was actually his first career KO, but I had heard about how big steps forward he had taken in the striking. He showed that off in his UFC debut. This is a guy who was known as a grappler throughout his career, so he brings in some pretty big wrestling chops. I think if he can use that wrestling ability just to keep this fight standing, there's a good chance he chops up Evloev on the feet and is able to win a decision or potentially get a stoppage here. So I like Mike Grundy at plus 170, just because I think he might have the wrestling chops to keep this one standing. And if he does, I think on the feet it could be one-sided.
Interesting. Okay. Good stuff. So a little action on the undercard, and then we obviously dissected all the card, all the fights on the main card, and I'm most excited for that first fight of the main card with Chimaev and how he does it. And obviously, if he wins, he would set the UFC record for the shortest amount of time between wins. Just fascinating. Go to Abu Dhabi and get two wins on Fight Island. Matthew, thanks so much for your time. I know you're really busy, and it's good insight as always.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it. Good. Best of luck this weekend. Take care.
Thank you.
Kicking is for losers.
All right. Thanks to Matthew Holt and thanks to Wes Reynolds. That'll do it for this podcast. Again, we did Monday with Preston Johnson and Buster Olney. Go check out that season preview. And it's all future, so even if the season starts, you can't get to it till maybe Saturday. There's still some interesting stuff that you can apply maybe on a game-to-game basis or even the futures market to win it all. So thanks to everyone. I know a lot of options out there. We just appreciate everyone taking the time to downloading, listening, and obviously subscribing as well and rating for all the ratings that we need to keep the podcast going. So thanks again to everyone, and we'll catch you next week here on the Behind the Bets podcast.